Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Gabriel Chan makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute on the publication of her book, Rust It Off, Why Country Australia is Fed Up, which is published by Viking and recently released to considerable favourable criticism. Now, she's well known to many of you from her appearances in the media, but I'll introduce her very briefly. As you know, we've had a very busy week this week with Mitch Fifield on Monday, so we're grateful you're all here and we're ready to roll again. So, Gabriel Chan has worked with News Corp for The Australian, for The Daily Telegraph. She's also worked for the ABC. She worked for Peter Collins when he was a minister in the coalition government in New South Wales, when he was Minister for Health and the Arts, and since 2013 writes for The Guardian. She's done the political live blog on The Guardian and other matters there. Now, as well as all that, Gabriel Chan has just published his book, as I mentioned, and the topic for tonight is similar to the book, a little bit different. The topic for tonight is Rust It Off, Navigating the Gulf Between Parliament and Rural Australia. Gabriel Chan, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Gerard. And thanks, Anne, for inviting me here today. I'd like to start with more than 20 years ago, when I arrived as a metropolitan migrant to a farm outside a small town. I had no connection with country Australia. I had no desire to live in country Australia, but I had rather inconveniently fallen in love with a farmer. I'd grown up in the Sydney suburbs, raised by a Singaporean Chinese father and an Anglo mother. I'd rarely been west of the Blue Mountains. Growing up in the 70s in outer suburban Sydney, I had not seen many faces like mine. I negotiated my way through school and landed a job at News Corp as a copy girl and then got a cadetship at The Australian. Started covering state politics in the 90s and then moved to the Canberra Press Gallery after Labor Premier Bob Carr won the 95 election. I moved to the farm in 96, the same year Pauline Hanson came to Parliament. My father was horrified. "Haven't you seen Wake in Fright?" He was terrified for his daughter as the political debate started to fracture again on Asian immigration. I was heading to a place that was smaller, more isolated, and much whiter. So for someone from my background, everything about moving to the farm left me unmoored. I was entering a conservative Anglo family culture in the conservative industry of farming near a conservative small town in a conservative electorate from a 3 metre wide terrace in Surrey Hills, what you would call a latte sipper, to the country, via the press gallery. There were two transitions to make. The first was cultural, from the city to the country. I noticed little things, everything from bone-crushing handshakes to the unspoken small-town rules. I puzzled over why the town had a lion dancing club from the Chinese New Year tradition until I realised it was the line dancing club. I saw social divides across class I had never noticed in the city. There was the farmer versus townie, Catholic versus Protestant. Of course, the city has class divides, but they are harder to see. In the city, demographics have postcodes. The second transition was from political insider to outsider. I left a life which revolved around a few square kilometres in Surrey Hills and then the federal parliamentary circle to a world which was completely disconnected. I struggled with that transition more because it changed my identity. It felt like I had lost something. In the process, I struck people who had diametrically opposed views to mine on the topics of the 90s, including the Mabo judgment. At that time, farmers were scared about losing their land. I didn't understand how some multi-generational farming families with a heartfelt emotional connection to place could not understand more ancient connections. So I heard reflections of Pauline Hanson and I railed against these other opinions and was shouty and ill at ease, when in reality my transition had been a gift. It was a chance to see the world from the other side. With young children, I was drawn into the necessary social infrastructure. Mothers' groups, playgroups, cake stalls, progress associations and school councils. Conversations about life, the universe and everything were conducted over nappy changes and Play-Doh. I related to people over cake recipes and rainfall, finding common ground. These conversations still included politics, but just not the high politics and reverse ferrets that we talk about in the press galleries, but politics in the way it touches people's lives. We covered all the ministerial areas, immigration, education, health, communications, foreign affairs and treasury. This was politics that crossed the divide between the inside world of parliament and the outside world of people who are not involved in the assorted industries of government and media. At the same time, I kept a foot in my other camp, returning to the Canberra Press Gallery when my youngest went to high school. The internet, the collapse in media revenue, social media and 24-hour news stations had changed things markedly since I had left, and it showed. Politicians and the media were more shouty, a bit like I was when I moved to the country, and voters were more angry. By 2016, a sizable portion of Britain voted to leave the European Union, as did a portion of the US for Donald Trump. I noticed the demographics of those voters looked a lot like my own community, older, wider, and firmly of a place. Malcolm Turnbull, who had been high in the polls, nearly lost the 2016 election. In order to think about what I considered the biggest political story, I needed to let go of the press gallery and return to my main street. I wanted to interview people I had known over the years, outside of my own social groups, to discover the detail of their lives and reflect on how they land on their political views. I wanted to have conversations with people who might not have the same views as me and find some common ground because I couldn't see much of it happening in Parliament. So this project became a piece of very slow journalism which aims to marry the micro on my main street with the macro of the national political debate. So what did I find? Our little town of Hardin-Murrumburra was built around a railway and it had gone through acute economic dislocation when the railway jobs were rationalised in the 80s. It has a population of 2,000, 3,000 if you count the surrounding farm districts. The abattoir came and went as the drought hit stock prices in the 90s and the noughties. Larger towns suck up our workers and while they're there, they do their grocery shopping and attendant services. Fellow residents who were beyond what they described as the New South Wales acronym, Newcastle, Sydney, Wollongong, felt ignored and complained of lack of services. Education is just one example. I first met Maggie Kate in our pony club, but later she attended our little high school. And I say little because last year the high school had 6 students in year 12, which makes it one of the smallest high schools in New South Wales. That means usually there is a very limited range of subjects. In the last year, for example, there was no physics, chemistry or 2-unit maths, let alone 3-unit maths. Maggie Kate had set her sights on being a doctor from the age of 8 when her little sister Deanna was born with a congenital issue. She got a lot of support from her mum Kate, who raised her without a father. Her grandfather Bernie, a stock carter, an abattoir worker, was a constant presence who also contributed. No family member had ever been to university before. So teachers pulled out all stops. Maggie Kate worked her backside off and became the first student anyone who can anyone can remember who has qualified for medicine straight out of our high school. It made front page news in our little local paper. But getting into medicine was only the start of the journey. Moving from a small town to the city is no mean feat for a young person with no supports there. Maggie Kate had spent a night or two in Sydney, so the move to the city away from family was daunting, and not just in personal but in cultural terms. In my region, which stretches from the thriving town of Young to the booming Canberra satellite town of Yass, our Australian-born population is 84%, and the top five migrant source nations by birth are England, New Zealand, Netherlands, Germany, and America, in that order. Compare my region to Australia's two largest cities and you will see the contrast. In Sydney, in Greater Sydney, in the 2016 census, just over 57% were Australian-born. And China is the top migrant birthplace, followed by England, India, New Zealand, and Vietnam. In Melbourne, Australian-born make up 60%, but the top migrant birthplace is India. Right now, half of the Australian population was either born overseas or had a parent born overseas. As my colleague, journalist and author George Megalogenis notes, the nation is quickly being separated into a series of distinct cultural identities. While the nation's southeast corner can be counted as majority new Australian, in the rest of the country, old Australia dominates. Megalogenis argues that the migrant intake, which remains at 190,000 a year, helped to create a top 10 world economy, but policymakers have a job ahead of them. By moving from city to country, I lived those two parts of Australia. And listening to politics as closely as I do, I can hear a lot of messages directed to either side of the divide, but less messages uniting us. The confusion I felt moving from city to country was a cultural journey. Likewise, Maggie Kate walked into a very diverse lecture theatre and she estimated the audience about 10% Anglo. She suffered my discombobulation in reverse. Far from being put off by her experience, Maggie Kate survived and thrived. She fell in with a group of international students, and why not? She was a country migrant. Just this year, our town's heart burst with pride as she qualified as a doctor. The friends she made at university will become lifelong, and earlier this year she travelled to Sri Lanka to a friend's wedding and dressed in a sari. Her grandfather, Bernie, who carted sheep for us for many years, could scarcely contain himself at his granddaughter's achievements. How does she keep all that in her head? And that made me think, we're only 90 minutes west of Canberra, 4 hours from Sydney, and yet the gap between country schools and city schools can be vast. My children boarded in Sydney for their senior years. For that reason, I'm sure no one would have batted an eyelid if one of mine got into medicine. Is it that odd that a kid in a little country local school should make it to medicine? And why was she the first in our school? The reason is the opportunities between country and city can be vast. It was brought home to me again a few weeks ago when I was covering the drought in southwest Queensland. One of the farmers also happened to be a spokeswoman for the Isolated Children's Parents Association, or ICPA. We got onto the subject of education and she told me there are eight very large government shires in Queensland that have no high school. We are a country that requires children by law to attend school. How is this possible? Education is just one of the noticeable divides. My fellow residents notice other gaps such as lack of drug rehabilitation services, pain management and shrinking health services. Connectivity and mobile services are also major issues. You can't have a baby in many country hospitals these days. People rail against city-centric decisions such as the New South Wales Council amalgamations. My fellow residents want jobs so they can stay in their place. They want infrastructure. They want access to health, education and broadband services that city people enjoy, but they want it without the crap city people have to put up with. The congestion, the pollution and the population pressure. One of the perennial debates, of course, in country towns and in our main street involves how to get a larger population to drive growth and critical mass. It is one of the sad songs sung about country Australia, and it is a real issue. Our exposure to population loss was brought home to me when the local abattoir closed in the millennium drought. As breadwinners lost their jobs, they took their families and moved on. Our school lost a full-time teacher, the principal became a teaching principal, our footy team, with its long proud history in the Group 9 competition, had to fold. I was working at my local paper at the time, and council was arguing about the local environmental plan. Flip to 2018, they're still arguing, having made little headway and with a template planning law which would suit a larger regional centre, but certainly not small towns like mine. But I would argue there's been an important shift since the noughties. Over my 20-something years at home, I can't count the number of times fellow residents have yearned for the big employer providing hundreds of jobs. Slowly, though, people are recognising that that really doesn't happen anymore. At the same time, we are transforming with a greater number of small businesses based around coffee, boutique homeware shops and specialty goods. Little towns across country Australia are working to attract more visitors to stop, spend a dollar, look around in the hope of one day they might come back. For example, we live equidistant to a smaller town, Joogeyong, population 280, which has remade itself as a food destination. It has a great cafe, the Long Track, which sits high on any coffee index, and a flash pub with add-on boutique shopping, which would not be out of place in the posh centres of Sydney and Melbourne. It's become a weekend favourite amongst Hume Highway travellers and nearby larger centres for the Sunday drive. In both towns, I see tree changers moving in who are escaping Sydney and Melbourne real estate prices, looking for a better lifestyle, a strong sense of community and more space while not giving up good coffee. They are joining locally born people to create and drive community groups to fill in government policy gaps. It's also driving a gentrification of small towns. So these changes are creating new demographics in rural and regional towns. It's mixing up the old rusted on conservatives, the rusted off voter, which I'll get to in a minute, with a dash of more progressive tree changer. If towns like mine could capitalise on the demand for larger lifestyle blocks than the quarter acre, the real estate agent and our local schools and employers would be very happy people. But we cannot because of planning laws. Tree changers and locals interested in buying land complain that even though there are a number of double blocks in town, they're not for sale. Because of the lack of larger blocks for sale, people put together two blocks to get the space they dream of in their country fantasy. As a result, we currently have one block of land for sale in town. Yet state government will not allow the release of new land, which is based on a formula for larger regional centres. We have people interested in opening businesses in our little main street, but we have vacant shops owned by landlords, a fair portion of whom will not maintain these spaces, leaving them literally to rot before our eyes. In some cases, they are a safety hazard, left accessible to vandals or bored youths. Yet communities have no recall, and locals and state governments stay silent on the issue. Landlords sit on these premises, often out-of-town landlords, as superannuation, yet the town is crying out for more businesses. Still, it's always embarrassing to talk about lack of services, as we are 90 minutes from Canberra, as I said, and 4 hours from Sydney, and therefore classed in a regional. Outer regional and remote community challenges would obviously trump our issues. But my aim was to tell the story that I know best. And I can tell you it's the very disconnected laws like these that are noticed on my main street and remarked on as examples of government failure to attend to community needs. Now, when I moved west of the divide, voters around me were firmly rusted on to coalition MPs. Historically, we've had Labor MPs at a state level, notably Ministers Billy Sheen and his son, now Justice Terry Sheen, but it's safe to say our voters are of a conservative bent. What I've witnessed, though, over the years is an increasing frustration with all politicians. Here is Ken, a friend and subject, talking about the major parties. The majors are there to show how they are going to fight to win the next election. It's like a business. They're trying to outdo the other one. They aren't worrying about the people out in Australia. They are just looking after themselves in one little corner. Bugger the ones outside. Ken was the son of a soldier settler who sold the farm when Ken was a young adult. He worked on a bread delivery run for a long time, swore he would never pick fruit and work in an abattoir, and then ended up doing both anyway. He found himself unemployed in his 50s, and now he volunteers at the local historic society and the state emergency services. For me, he epitomises the rusted-off country voter. In the Senate, he told me he votes for all the, quote, silly ones. He stopped voting Liberal after the former state and federal MPs, Albie Schultz, himself a former abattoir worker, retired. Ken told me when Hanson got in, over at the men's shed, didn't they go right off? I said, she's going to get in and stir the others up. Well, now they're listening. If I think about the people who are actively angry, I think about the neglected class. While people look on in horror at the Canberra cycle of spills and dysfunction, the ones who change their vote form the big middle of our little town. This neglected class comprise the people who service the farms, look after the very young and the very old, keep the schools going, keep the hospitals running, do the council work in the streets as opposed to sitting as councillors, stock the supermarket shelves. The neglected class are the very foundation of country towns, but you don't hear about them from most rural MPs who tend to focus on farmers and agriculture as the backbone of Australia. The neglected class feel they have no sway over governments or politicians, and they feel inadequately represented by the media. They have no lobby group representing them. This they share with some city voters, but the neglected class, previously rusted on voters, are rusting off the major parties in larger numbers. They expect the world to change, but not too fast. Conversations around discontent and the failings of government in country areas are invariably followed by, but I wouldn't live in the city if you paid me. People tend to be slightly more socially conservative, though not always, witness the same-sex marriage vote, and economically interventionist. Their big beef is with lack of trust and with government and lack of consideration of them from city-based power centres. They know their MP can't fix every issue, but they want he or she to have a go. They don't mind immigration as long as it's done on the nation's terms rather than the immigrants' terms. They feel if migrants want to come to Australia, they should be grateful. This view of immigration, particularly of Muslim migration as the latest group to arrive in numbers, is confronting as the daughter of a migrant and occurs in our particular demographic and cultural context. These voters have many similarities with the swinging voters in the outer edges of our cities, but geography and culture differentiates them. Those around me identify strongly as country people. They are obviously broad brushstrokes. But I think of these country town people as the neglected class because they sit between those who rely more heavily on government payments and landholders and larger businesses, including many farmers, who have enough assets to cushion them from an economic shock. When I think about what might happen in rural politics in the future, I look to the metropolitan electorates that hold the city version of the neglected class. No MP can get too complacent in the outer edges of our cities. These voters make their politicians work. Rural and regional main streets are starting to understand that. Like a bull led by a nose ring, rural electorates have more power than we think. That ring is an illusion. The bull still holds the power if he chooses to exercise it. Country towns are in a time of political transition and no one knows which way the bull will jump. Country voters are one fright away from determining governments. We represent 30% of Australia and could have the balance of power in any future government. As Australia wakes up to find its sixth change of Prime Minister in a decade, the big trend I see is the community moving ahead of government. I can see exciting developments where country communities are getting together to fill gaps left by government. Our town has been very active in supporting our locally educated children through locally raised funds for further education, trades and tertiary qualifications to broaden their horizon via an organisation called the Hardin District Education Foundation. In Yarkandandah, Victoria, they've hooked up their medical centre, community fuel station and a greenfield housing site to renewable power. They are looking to be totally renewable by 2022. In Mingala, a tiny town on the New South Wales-Queensland border, they're actively have sought out African refugees to stem the population decline and keep their schools going. Mingala welcomed four families with children by renovating housing and providing jobs. As an aside, this week we discovered the federal government will impose new visa conditions on skilled migrants to settle outside major cities for up to 5 years. I would love more migrants to move to our regions and my town. After all, overseas trained Muslim Indian doctors, two of whom married local girls and subsequently settled, have looked after us for nearly 40 years. Yet for all this experience, there is still some disquiet in parts of our community about Muslim migration. My only warning to government from my experience is around the compulsory aspect of the policy. Small communities with high numbers of locally born population must feel comfortable and migrants must have jobs and housing. Otherwise, you set both the community and the migrant up to fail. Forced settlement has the capacity to feed divisions, but done by local agreement, such policies would build a diversity bridge to stop the cultural confusion experienced by myself and Maggie Kate. Alas, we communities cannot solve everything. Government provide policy scaffolding for our lives, our economy and our environment. Governments cannot survive without community support and communities can't survive without governments. We can only do so much in our own communities and this is where we really need government to function well. So in conclusion, here are some of my lessons. Lesson one, after decades of economically rationalist policies and letting the free market rip, country communities are confused by our place. We are told as towns and businesses get big or get out. We are told if we can't get a job, move to the city. When attachment to place and its people provides most capacity for individual support. Rural Australia contributes 40% to our economy, but we are considered by some as old Australia, either rednecks or salt of the earth with no nuance in between. We also must let go of our own stereotyping of city people. Lesson two, the best of our country MPs understand the importance of place. But the worst of them play up the narrative that city people will never understand us. We need to let go of the decline narrative and find better ways to describe the challenges and strengths of our communities. We need to scrutinise our representatives and not settle for second best. Lesson three, across the country, communities are moving ahead of government. In my community alone, I can give examples of Indigenous reconciliation, privately provided fast broadband, bridging the education gap, innovative models of crisis housing, and small town economic development. These are some of the best bush stories. Lesson four, we need to build from within and overcome social divides within our own community. Like our politicians, Main Street community leaders need to consult with the rest of the community. As political disruption continues, governments will run at us with money. And country communities need to have our own priorities ready to go. That way we can tell our MPs we don't want a school hall next to the old one or a community-built footpath, but we want a high-speed internet learning centre for our kids, whatever your local priority is. We can't expect governments to put the right things in place if we haven't told them what we want. Ultimately, the lesson is federal, state and local governments, politicians and public servants need to listen. Country voters are proving that they're no longer adverse to upending the furniture if they don't like what's on the table. When I started writing Rusted Off, I thought hard about place. I felt comfortable in Sydney where I grew up, but there was no sense of belonging. I realised the other day I've now spent more time at the farm than any other address in my life. While some might see me as a blow-in, I don't feel like a blow-in. I feel like part of the community, and it's from that vantage point that I wrote this book. My new home represents the other half of Australia that completes the whole nation, two halves of the one place, and I celebrate it whole. Thank you.
Many thanks to Gabriel Chan. Now, I mentioned this is Gabriel Chan's first book, Rusted Off, Why Country Australia is Fed Up, and we've got copies of that tonight, and I'm sure the author would be happy to sign it. She also earlier did an edited collection, War Diaries, which were published by The Australian some years ago. So now we come to question and discussion. We have plenty of time. Thanks for finishing on time. So everyone's happy today. I think you said, thanks for a terrific paper. Now, I just want to sort of make a few challenging points.
Yep.
I mean, I think you mentioned at some stage you referred to the neglected class. But I think it's also true that something like one-third of Australians virtually pay net tax and two-thirds of Australia pay very little net tax. So people who are living who are not particularly well off in a place like Hardin, if they're on a pension, if they're on Medicare, if they're in government schools, I mean, a lot of this is being carried by people living in the cities and people on farms and others who are earning higher income. So coming from outside, a lot of people wouldn't regard people living in the circumstance you regard as a neglected class as in any sense neglected, and yet they obviously do. So what's the explanation for that?
Yeah, I make the point in the book that, and I use the Grants Commission's figures, which obviously show that country communities, that our services cost a lot more than city communities. Absolute no-brainer. Doesn't mean the services are better, it just means they cost more to provide that. So I think largely the way the conversations I had, the people were talking about feeling left out of the political debate because, you know, there are a lot of people talking about, say, government on people on government payments right at the bottom rung, and they hear a lot of talk about farmers, you know, like my husband, but they don't hear talk in between. So I think it's a perception, a thing of perception, and, you know, I would agree, you know, because I quote the Grants Commission figures, but it really is, for them, a problem of perception, I would say.
Thanks. So, Commissioner?
You mentioned very, very quickly as you went through drug rehabilitation services. Now, in America in the 1990s, the opioid crisis actually started in small towns and migrated to the cities. Are we seeing anything like that in the smaller towns in New South Wales and Australia?
Absolutely. I cover that in the book. We have someone here who I quote in the book who's the local chemist, and he basically took me in and showed me his safe for addictive drugs, and it has, you know, grown massively over the last few decades, basically, since he graduated from pharmacy. And I think it is a real problem, and all the figures, I think, which I quote in the book, show that there is higher incidence in regional areas, and that chemist who is in the room gives a warning about that opioid crisis heading our way. I think recently, too, there was a survey just this week which looked at urine samples across the country and showed an increase. So, yeah, it's there in the figures.
There's a question. Okay, we'll go up there, then we'll come down here. We'll go to Turnvere and then we'll come to you. Thanks.
Yep. Me?
Yep.
Thanks, Jim. Gabriel,
just hold it up to you.
Gabriel, thanks for your talk. Tanvir Ahmed, I'm a psychiatrist. But I, for several years, I flew to country towns like Tamworth, Grafton and Armidale, and just some observations. So the first one I'd ask is about the reasons for movement, be it the tree changes, etc. And to what extent is it cultural in terms of not feeling like their identity in the city is not quite the same as it was particularly with migration, feeling like their local environment. There's a great word called solastalgia. It means when your current home no longer feels like home. And that's certainly one of the arguments for, you know, what might be called, say, white flight and the like. So that's one thing I'd ask you to comment on. And the other one is, having spent a bit of time, I certainly haven't lived at length in country towns, to what extent is the idea of the tight-knit community increasingly a myth to some extent? I mean, we have very capital-intensive agriculture in Australia, so it's often low-density population, people living, you know, quite long distances from each other. And also, most households, they're both, same couples, they're both working, and they're not necessarily both working in the same place. So you're getting many of the, to some degree, the atomisation of the city, sometimes in country areas too. So I'd love your comments on those two points.
I haven't spoken to anyone who's moved into town and given that reason for whatever that fabulous word was used, that they feel out of place in the city. It's more about congestion. In fact, to the contrary, I talk about the city of Young, which has had a big increase in Lebanese Australians, Muslims, from the southwestern area, and they talk about classic tree changer reasons. You know, they're worried about drugs with their kids, they're worried, you know, the congestion, working long hours, and so there is quite a population moving into that town of Young. On the other issue, close-knit communities, I think, you know, I can only talk about my own perception of my community, and it remains close-knit, but what worries me is that kind of division between the different classes, and you know, as people don't work on farms as much anymore, there's less connection with the farmers, and I think that's also a reason why they're kind of rusting off maybe a party like the National Party, because they don't feel like they have a dog in that race anymore. They don't feel, you know, like it's going to affect them, even though, of course, incomes going on to farms does affect the general economy. You know, you're seeing that with the drought now. But, yeah, so more than sort of community, I would say the changes in technologies is around agriculture, particularly in my town, is really having an effect on that social division in town.
Gabriel, my name's Peter Reid, and thank you very much for a fascinating presentation. I have had a reverse journey to you, in as much as I grew up, my first 12 years of education, both primary and secondary, were in a city boarding school where I was very much the minority as the city kid against the country kids, who were the majority. So I've come at it from a very different perspective, but I think a lot of your comments really resonate with me. And the one you just recently mentioned in your last comments was the success of the Lebanese migration into Young, because I have followed that. Mm. I had the good fortune of travelling to Young when I was at university with a country colleague, and this was in the days long before you went there, when you could still catch an overnight mail train to Young. And so I went there on the Tamora Mail, and that's not going to happen again. But the point of the anecdote is that I've followed the, what you might call, the sociological changes in that particular region ever since, for the last 50 years. And I'm very encouraged to hear about... I'm very encouraged to hear about that Muslim successful integration in Young. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so Young is a town where your cherries probably come from. It's mostly horticulture. So as a result, it has quite small blocks as compared to around our town, which has large broadacre farming. I mean, there is some broadacre around Young, but close into the centre, it tends to be horticulture. And the first Lebanese Muslims went there in the 70s because it reminded them of, you know, the orchards from home. And now the children are coming or people out of southwestern Sydney are moving into that area. It has a mosque. A mosque has been converted from the old drive-in, actually, recently. So the old drive-in cinema's been turned into a mosque.
A new sacred site.
That's right, that's right. Many people's first kiss, I would imagine. It also has an Islamic school that was built in the last couple of years, and there has been nary a whisper of dissent in that area. There was a very high-profile arrest of a person who is alleged to have consorted with ISIS, and I don't think that case has come through yet. But after that, the local Muslim community got together with the police, the local politicians, the councillors, you know, all different groups, and they did an open day and basically, you know, put someone out the front and said, ask me anything about Islam, you know, what do you want to know? And there really has been very little pushback.
I met David Sharma, who's the Liberal candidate for Wentworth in the past week, and I said, what are you picking up? And he said, well, nothing from Rosebay Wharf, because everyone's happy. But he's also pitching up at Bondi Junction Station in the mornings to try and engage with people there. And I said, well, what's the reaction? He said, nobody wants to talk to you. He said, people are browned off. They hate politicians. They think they've been stabbed in the back with everything that's happened in the last few years. So he's picking up what I see as an urban version of the rusted off that you're spotting in the country areas. So I think it might be more nationally endemic than just located in the rural base. Would you?
The only thing I would say is I think the Senate vote figures out of the 2016 election and for the last couple of elections have shown the further from the GPO you get, further away from the GPO, the higher the vote for minor parties and independents. So maybe they're translating, instead of being a Liberal-Labor competition, it tends to be coalition, Liberal or National Party versus independent or minor party. I agree that there is that rusted off vote in the cities. I couldn't tell that story, you know.
No.
I could only tell. Next book, volume two. Yeah.
Thanks, Gabriel. Bill Herditch. I loved your talk. Thanks very much. I'm going to love your book too, I know. I get a feeling we do ourselves a disservice by the words country and city. And by emphasising those, I cringe. I never listen to sort of Australia All Over on there because it just drives me mad because there's so much condescension. And every time you see something or hear something about the country or rural, it's all sort of sympathy and sort of. So I just wonder whether we need to have a new language about talking about just people, small businesses, the struggles of a corner shop, the high street. You know. So I want to ask about language a little bit and. Just see if there's something more we can do there to sort of break down this sort of setup that we set ourselves up to have. I mean, I grew up in the bush. I was born in a four-bed hospital. And I just hate the way the city sort of looks down its nose.
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know what you do. I don't know if you have any suggestions for new words for city and country. Let me know. The whole book was about trying to improve that conversation. So, you know, I think probably the not-so-great end of rural representation, obviously, if you're one MP in a parliament and you're trying to leverage funding for your area, you're going to sing what I call those sad songs, right? And so the decline narrative plays out of that. We're also to blame as, you know, me as journalists, you know, sometimes we write the simplistic story. But you can see with the drought coverage, there's huge goodwill in the city for country people. You know, it's not that metropolitan people don't understand. In fact, I would argue that often it's sort of overly sympathetic for the country and not understanding, you know, whether either, you know, we're somewhere in between those kind of salt of the earth and rednecks or deplorables and adorables, whatever you want to call it. But So I don't know how you change the language around it. The only thing, you know, it really annoyed me, which is why I sort of wrote the book, and I say in the book that's the only thing, you know, that I can do to change the debate. But I think the more cross-pollination that happens between city and country, the better. And as I said, you know, as people come through country towns and stop and have a coffee and do all of that stuff, they generally see it's more nuanced than they get.
So there's a question. Whoever's got the microphone's got the call. Yep, yep.
Gabriel May Patterson. I come from a country town called Adelaide. it too shrinks and has many of the same concerns that you've articulated from other parts of country Australia. You speak of the voters being rusted off and identifying with independents who mirror their voice but really have a solution to the challenge that they face. And many in the community reflect the same challenge and have been doing so in my exposure to public life for the last 40 or 50 years, but really have solutions to that challenge. They don't believe politicians or public servants understand the issue and therefore don't have a solution. And your presentation articulated the challenges, but rarely the solutions. I don't know whether your book goes into that, but I'd be interested to hear your views on what some of the solutions might look like.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so I touched on at the end on one of those things. That is, you know, communities coming together and working some stuff out for themselves, basically, and getting some priorities together. And that's what we're trying to do in Harden through a local economic development group. You know, what are our priorities? So, you know, if Kevin Rudd comes at you at a million miles wanting to build a school hall, can you say, you know, no, I don't want that? But also, we talk a lot on the main street about engaging more with the local member. And I know certainly in our state MP, we've had lots of conversations recently because you won't know, but we had a by-election and the margin was cut substantially. It was a National Party seat. Katrina Hodgkinson retired and Steph Cook won that seat. And she has spent a lot of time coming in and talking to us, and as we have with her, and trying to engage with your MP, because, you know, you're absolutely right. It's not easy as a major party politician, because you actually are responsible for the solutions, or you're seen as part of the problem. And Catherine Murphy wrote a really great essay on this, you know, the political life is no life at all. And it's all about the challenges for MPs. And, you know, you talk to a lot of people, including me, and who say, well, you know, why don't you go into politics? Well, no thanks. You know, so I think you're right. And I think it's just engagement, you know. So if you have a problem, every time Steph is in, or our local members, I put on my Facebook page, your MP's here, go and have a talk to them. Don't whinge on the main street and then say, you know, you can't get into their office. They're here to talk to you. Talk to them about, you know, the things that you want to see. So engagement is the only thing that I can offer, really.
And?
April, as you're talking, I was thinking this is really not a new thing.
No, not at all.
Yes. But if you're thinking about politicians, surely your local politicians should be the first port of call, and surely your local shires, councillors, whatever, should be screaming to the heavens, to the local members. What are they doing?
What are the local councillors doing?
What's local government doing in all of this?
So local...
They seem to take a lot of money, but they don't seem to have a lot of outcomes.
Yeah. So we've obviously had the New South Wales Council amalgamations, and I talk about in the book when I worked for the local newspaper when my kids were little. And we had, you know, I'd cover local town hall meetings where, you know, you'd have a group of people like this and everyone would be angry and shouty and talk to the mayor, and the mayor would say, well, it's the bloody state government, or it's the federal government, or it's, you know, this or that. So, you know... I think the best of councillors pass on the messages, and the worst, you know, just kind of rail, as with all levels of politics and media commentators rail about, you know, some of the issues without providing the solutions. So, yeah, local government is obviously there at the coalface, and the best of them pass it on and the worst don't.
Thank you. We're currently very much focused on the drought.
Yes.
Farmers in the drought. That may last. The interest may wane. Could you make a comment on how that may affect or influence the feeling between the city and the country? I go into been around the city here, and there are women going around so highly dressed that I'm sure they don't think about anything other than their cosmetics. But thank you.
So a reflection on drought that how it will affect the relationship.
It doesn't involve cosmetics.
No. No,
hang on, we got it. Reflection on the drought,
okay.
When it changes. Yeah, okay.
So when I was up in Tarlaville in the last month or so, they were all very amused that drought coverage had spiked massively when New South Wales started to get heavily into drought when they had been in drought for nearly 7 years. So media attention does wax and wane, obviously. I notice also in that area particularly there's been some concern about the huge... While grateful for the huge outpouring and cash into different charities, they're a bit worried about where it's going because often a lot of people aren't seeing that. So I think... But in terms of relationship between city and country, I think it reminds people that you know, there are country communities out there. Certainly I was... When I lived in the city, wasn't really focused on... country communities, they were so removed from my life experience, I had no idea. So, I mean, I guess it just waves a flag, you know, we're out there. But I don't think it will change country communities or the relationship between the two markedly.
There's a second last question there. Can you get... Yeah. Oh, we've got two to get... We've got one, two and three. Yeah, one, three.
Oh,
yep.
Thanks for your talk, it's very interesting. One of the perennial problems with all New South Wales country towns and Queensland is the retention of the young.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty pessimistic about most country towns retaining young people. I'd be interested to know if that young doctor has gone back to work in the country or...
Yeah, she
still,
is.
Is it right?
Yeah, she has. She has. She wanted to... she said right from the start, she's a very focused girl, a woman. She said she would come back and work in the country, and she's going to work at a town nearby. She doesn't want to work in town because she said that would be, you know, quite freaky to deal with the people that she knew so well. So she needed a little bit of kind of removal from that. But generally what happens now is, you know, people move away for qualifications and then, you know, a proportion of them come back. And so we have seen quite a few coming back. Our population has been slightly above static. So I think, you know, in a shire of 3,000 or statistical area, we got 50 more people in the last census. So people are coming back. What I would say about retaining people, though, and qualifications, again, comes back to education. So... the thing I hadn't that surprised me most from my conversations that I hadn't expected from covering politics the whole time was the depth of feeling about the hollowing out of trade and further education as opposed to university education. And the kids and the employers both feel that there's this such an emphasis on university education that, you know, even if kids want to go to TAFE or further education, they don't get directed there. You know, as one guy who's in his early 20s said to me, the path to uni was like the Hume Highway and the path to TAFE or technical education was like this goat track off the side, you know, a little track. And I think all the changes over TAFE over the years has had a process of hollowing out that system, especially the smaller campuses. So what tends to happen is, say, for hairdressing, they'll have a teacher teaching at a bigger centre like Wagga, rather than the local TAFE, which for us is young. And so it means kids have to get there. Now, if they're combining that qualification with, say, year 11 and 12, it's very hard for them to get there. And, you know, that is one case I quote in the book. You know, hairdressing, a job you could get in any single country town. We have 6 hairdressers in our town, you know, of 2,000 to 3,000 people. So she could not combine, well, she has, but with difficulty. She had to go to Goulburn, whereas Young was much closer for her. But they didn't have a teacher teaching at Young. So those sorts of things, I think, play into this idea that, you know, getting qualifications that will keep you in place, apart from doctor, nurse, teacher, aren't really valued. But we are seeing people come back. And that's really rewarding, I think, especially for the Education Foundation.
Quick second last question, John.
Thank you, John Doherty. Gabriel, wonderful dissertation. Thanks. I appreciate it very much. And I'm part farmer too. I've been in the Tanoni near Taree area for 50 years, so I've got both sides of it.
Yeah.
It's a little easier in that area, perhaps, at Young. But the key to any development is always investment. The only reason rural Australia keeps going is because of city investment from primarily Sydney and Melbourne and other capital cities. One of the problems that you touched on was the state government. I ignore the federal government. Apart from handouts for education, all these other important things, they're not relevant to the activities in a town. The state government runs all the activities, but it tends to stand behind a lot of blame for the federal part. But looking at the real issue, the Crown owns everything in the state. It owns the land, it owns resources underneath it. We see continually in the state of New South Wales and now in Victoria that the Crown denies the development of underground resources where it sees they're environmentally sensitive. You touched on this issue in regard to planning arrangements, and it's the same as the city or outer suburbs. One of the things that would help a great deal is if the planning that was in the country area was in fact much freer than it is in the city. And in fact, and I don't know quite this, how this would change, but it would help a place like Young, it would help a place like Gloucester, it would help a place like Nimble up the north coast. If in fact the resource, be it gas, coal, iron ore, whatever it is, gold, or some other resource, was in fact freely available for development with the right thing, because it would bring employment and investment. So all these other services, education, etc. How do you see the possibility of the New South Wales state government being able to change in that manner? You just touched on it, but how do you see the reality of politics?
Just a brief response.
I don't. I really don't. I spoke to the Planning Institute conference in Orange, and that was all around decentralisation and that sort of thing. I mean, just watching the national political sphere, you know, the environmental regulations, things like the Water Trigger Act, I don't see it changing anytime soon. And don't forget, you know, the mining versus farm usage arguments are still a big thing, and so that is exercising a lot of people in country seats too. Another reason for rusted off, you know, some farmers, you know, voting Green for the first time ever in their lives. So, you know, it's a pretty messy political situation.
Final point, I mean, 30 years ago, you probably couldn't do what you do now. You couldn't report national politics from a farm in New South Wales. So obviously, you've benefited enormously from the technology. A quick response on that, and then we know how proud the town was when your first local doctor graduated. Are they proud of you? For your first book?
They are. You know, like, Jared, I did not sleep for the last year writing this book, because writing about your own local community is a really scary thing. And it's like eating, you know, that Japanese stonefish. You can die at any moment. And so I was really, really overwhelmed with the support that the town gave me. And whether they're proud of me, I don't know. But, yeah, I was really, really heartened by the support. And some of that was just, oh, you like us, do you? And I said, of course I do. But I think the, you know, feeling like it was worth writing about was a big thing for them. So,
Darren, can I say my daughter lives in Hutton, and she is proud of you.
Oh, thank you.
I can absolutely say that for a fact.
Thank you.
Well, that's right. That was a good interjection. We don't have many good interjections, actually. We don't have any many interjections. Well, that's good. So there's evidence that your Hutton's proud of you. So look, so thanks for a great performance tonight and for an important book. We've got copies of it on sale, rusted off. But we're right on time, so I want to say congratulations and good luck.
Thanks, Vera.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.